And welcome to a Juno Afternoon. My name is Jamie Waste. I'll be your host for today's program. Following National Native News, Scott Burton will be here to preview tomorrow's videotaping of Writers Showcase, then highlights of the next bike adventure series, a trip through Vietnam, Cambodia, and Thailand with guests Colin Wakefield Gorka and Brianna Swanson. Maria Levischuk and Andrea Campbell will share news about this year's Empty Bowls Banquet. And Jesse Post will be here along with, I think it's Dave Campbell, to highlight the UAS Alumni Annual Spring Dinner and Auction on Saturday. Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, Music, and more up next on a Juno Afternoon on KTOO Juno.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Hopi tribe is urging the Flagstaff City Council to approve a resolution to a lawsuit over snowmaking on the San Francisco Peaks. The tribe says the agreement would further protect the area more than a dozen southwestern tribes consider sacred. Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports.
The settlement would require the city to construct $1.5 million earthen filtration system to further treat reclaimed wastewater it sells to Arizona Snow Bowl. The Hopi tribe says the system would improve the quality of water shipped to the ski resort. Under the agreement, however, the tribe would still be able to oppose snowmaking on the peaks. The Flagstaff City Council must approve the settlement, but delayed consideration because of the project's costs. Council members also worry that other tribes weren't consulted. The Navajo Nation president and council recently announced their opposition to the agreement. The Hopi tribe sued the city of Flagstaff in 2011 and said the sale of reclaimed water for snowmaking created a public nuisance through environmental contamination. Snow Bowl began making snow 3 years ago to extend its ski season and can purchase up to 1.5 million gallons per day between November and February. I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
Students, faculty, and staff from 37 tribal colleges across the country are in Minneapolis, Minnesota for the American Indian Higher Education Conference. This week, the students have competed in a number of activities, such as archery, hand games, and a knowledge bowl. Tribal college leaders are also conducting business there. Rhonda Lavaldo spoke with some presidents about a couple key issues and has this report.
As tribal college students meet for academic competitions at the American Indian Higher Education Conference, or AHEC, their administrations talk about their issues facing them. Mahunka Morgan, Little Priest Tribal College president, says funding colleges is vital.
I would say they're the most important institution right now in our community that needs to be further developed, you know, to their fullest potential. And so resources need to be committed to the colleges. And I know that that's going to have a lasting impact once that's done. And it's good to see here that so many students and tribes are committed to that purpose.
With the upcoming U.S. presidential election, Nueta Hidatsa Sahanish Tribal College President Twyla Baker Demaray is encouraging Native people to be engaged in the voting process.
We are very much so preparing ourselves for what's coming next. Thankfully, we've got some allies in the Senate and in the House who kind of have our back in the first place and that are going to be there for a while longer, even after this administration change. I've been so grateful to President Obama for all of the initiatives. I am encouraging a lot of people to get involved, find out about the candidates, and make their choice because there's some serious threats to Indian country out there, to our sovereignty, that people are oddly taking seriously. Basically, we just have to be ready. We really have to be ready, and we have to make sure that we are making our voice heard in Indian country.
AHEC saw its highest attendance record of 1,100 at this year's conference, and is being hosted by the Woodlands Tribal Colleges. The theme is Harvesting Knowledge, Building Resiliency. I'm Rhonda Lavaldo for National Native News.
The leader of the Fairbanks Native Association, a nonprofit which advocates for the Native community, urged people this week to make their voices heard to lawmakers and leaders about Alaska's state budget. Tribal leaders across the state are worried cuts will be on the backs of people in rural Alaska. Fairbanks Native Association Executive Director Steve Guinness.
You know, the behavioral health budgets is something that concerns me because we get over $3 million from the state to run detox, women's and children, Ralph Perdue, and an aftercare program. This year, we did something different. We asked our consumers to testify of how these programs are working for them, how it's making a change in their lives, and it helped. It really helped.
Guinness spoke to tribal leaders and community members from Interior Alaska gathered this week in Fairbanks. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. The Albuquerque Chamber of Commerce's Convention and Tourism Department welcomes the Gathering of Nations to the Wise Pies Arena, a.k.a. The Pit, April 29th and 30th. Information on services and the Gathering of Nations at ahcnm.org. If you or a loved one suffer from alcohol addiction, hear how recovery is possible from those who've had their day one at nativenews.net. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And welcome to a Juneau afternoon, and a big welcome to Scott Burton right here in the KTOO studios on the other side of the microphone here, Scott. That's a good thing.
Thanks for having me, Jamie.
Well, you're welcome, and I'm really excited about why you're here, because Writer's Showcase is something that's, I guess, kind of new, or relatively new, or in the last few years, maybe something new that's a part of kind of the arts and culture programming here that this building generates for the community. So tell us about Writer's Showcase.
Yeah, thanks, Jamie. We're closing in on our 10th program, I think, and it's gaining popularity. People are submitting. We're getting lots of submissions for the show. Want to put a big heartfelt thanks out to everyone who has written and submitted to the show. It's been a lot of hard work, and I really am thankful for that. It's also pretty neat to have a show that people are writing for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people know that here's this opportunity to have their prose read by a professional actor to a statewide audience, and a worldwide audience, really, because it goes up on YouTube as well, like all of our shows at 360 North. So it's a cool show, and it's 1 hour long. We record it downstairs at 360. And for an hour, you get to sit in this room. And I don't know if all of our listeners are familiar with PRI's Selected Shorts. I bet a fair number are. But PRI's Selected Shorts is the same thing, although they don't do television that I know of. Theirs is more radio-based. But you're in this intimate setting, and really it's a collaboration, right, between the writer who created this prose. But then you have this actor who interprets their prose and presents it in a very vivid way. And so, you know, there is the temptation to have the writer read their own work. But I, as a writer myself, I know that I have baggage with my own work, mm-hmm. and I'm attached to it. When you give it to a professional actor, they're completely separated from it and approach it in a professional way, you know, with all of their craft tricks and artful tricks. And then they take that prose to new places. It's really cool.
So we'll continue up on the topic of Writer's Showcase in a moment. But tomorrow, you have the next installment or show of this. So
that's
why don't
right.
you describe what happens tomorrow and an invite to the audience and things like that?
Sure. So admission is free. Doors open at 6:30 tomorrow, Thursday, March 17th. And then the cameras will roll at 7 o'clock. It's an hour program. Tomorrow, we are featuring writing by local Jonas Lamb. It's a very fun narrative poem about a free wood stove. And as we all know, nothing.
No such thing.
There is no such thing as free anything. It's really funny. And that's going to be presented by Clint Farr. And if you know Clint, he's great. He is a great reader, a great actor, and has a great sense of humor, which this piece, he's the perfect fit for that narrator. Also, local Loretto Jones, Captain Jones, has a piece, and that will be presented by Patricia Hull. I'm sure a lot of our listeners mm-hmm. are familiar with her work, a great actor as well. And then Lee Newman from her memoir, Still Points North, just a beautiful, about a relationship between a father and daughter, her and her father. And that will be presented by Elizabeth Davis. And if I think a lot of folks are familiar with her work as an actor, too. It's just phenomenal. So it'll be a great show.
So this is tomorrow evening, mm-hmm. and so free to the mm-hmm. audience. So you want folks to come. And
yeah.
So what's the response? What's the role of the audience in a setting like this?
I think with any performance art, the performers love the feedback from the crowd. You know, to hear them gasp or laugh, you know, to clap, to their role really is just to enjoy themselves. But, you know, we don't want it to be like crickets in the audience. We want an interactive crowd, as with almost all of our television shows down there. And so just their presence alone gives energy to the performers. And energy to the piece. So I guess, if you will, it becomes a three-part collaboration. And then the cameras are involved too, and I'll be hosting. And it is, it's a night, you sit in that studio and the sound quality in there, the lights are down, the sound quality is really nice. And just for an hour, you get to escape from the rain outside.
Writers Showcase, so this is tomorrow evening, right here at 360. Anything else you want people to know about, either in terms of the showcase itself or just the future of the program, perhaps?
Our next show will be on, we're going to record on June 2nd, and so our deadline is at the end of April. So if you're interested in submitting to the program and being part of it, we'd love for you to do so. Anything from about 3 minutes to 15 minutes is what we say. As far as length, when you read your piece aloud, submit it to arts@ktoo.org. We'd love to see your work, and maybe it will be on television. So,
which is very cool.
Yeah.
It may sound kind of antiquated, TV, you know.
Television. You'll be on television.
It lives on. There's something powerful about it. Anything else you wanted to add?
Oh, I guess a couple other notes. We did a concert with Harm. Two Saturdays ago, I think it was, and that premieres tonight on 360 North at 8 p.m. So check that out. Our very own Annie Bartholomew is in that band.
Yeah, and that's a, like a Fairbanks bass band, is that correct?
Yeah,
but Annie's
they
a part
call themselves
of it.
An Alaskan ensemble, and I know some of them are now migrating to Juneau. I'm not sure where to say they're based from.
Yeah, Alaska.
Greater Alaska. Let's see. And then, this is a good example. We have three series. We have Writers Showcase. We have Alaska Originals, which is the concert I'm talking about tonight. And then we're doing a special show with Ernestine Hayes a week from tomorrow on the 25th, same spot at 360. And I get to sit down with Ernestine Hayes, and for an hour we're going to do this multimedia exploration of her writing, her influences. We have some video, some of the lectures and speeches that she's done. She's going to do readings. So just a really in-depth look at her art. So looking forward to that. Again, admission is free. That's on Friday, a week from tomorrow, and that's at 360 as well. So fun stuff happening downstairs.
Very good. Arts and culture being promoted and advanced here on KTOO. Scott Burton, thank you very much.
Thanks, Jamie.
It's the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 16th of March, 2016. It's the birthday of the comedian Hannah Youngman, born London, 1906. He said, "I was so ugly when I was born, the doctor slapped my mother." Grew up in New York City, made his first appearance, amateur night. He was 16, started to develop his act, delivering one-liners while playing a violin, telling at least 50 jokes in 8 minutes. One-liners like, "When I read about the evils of drinking, I gave up reading." He said, "I wanted to be an atheist, but they have no holidays. And if at first you don't succeed, so much for skydiving." It's the birthday of the poet Cesar Vallejo, born in Santiago de Chuco, Peru, 1892. As a young man, he was imprisoned by the Trujillo regime, moved to Paris, where he slept on subways and park benches for months. He was sick and depressed, unemployed. Later, he witnessed the Spanish Civil War. A critic wrote of Vallejo, "A constant feature of his poetry is a compassionate awareness of and guilt-ridden sense of responsibility for the suffering of others." Vallejo, who said, "The arts are not just painting and poetry and music, eating, drinking, walking are also arts. Every act is an art." It's the birthday of the novelist Alice Hoffman, born Long Island, 1952. Her novels, like Practical Magic and The Dove Keepers, combine magical realism and romance with a touch of irony. Her memoir, Survival Lessons, is about what she learned while enduring treatment for breast cancer. And it was on this day in 1926, Robert Goddard launched the first liquid-fueled rocket. He paid for his rockets out of his own pocket, but finally got a grant from the Smithsonian, and he wrote a paper in which he speculated that rockets could be used to reach the moon, for which he was ridiculed by the New York Times. People called him the Moon Man. And after the successful launch of the Apollo 11 spacecraft in 1969, the Times printed a retraction of the ridicule of Goddard and his idea of reaching the moon. Here's a poem for today by Kim Dower, Goodbye to James Garner. Fans loved him as Rockford, Maverick, a man's man, had your back, cool, did the right thing. I loved him for being Doris Day's husband in a movie I cut class to see. Fifth grade, played at the Riviera, only old men and me during the day. Went alone, told no one, but I had a gigantic crush. He was an OBGYN, she was a mom, marriage in jeopardy. Couples in movies stayed together in the 60s. Well, out in the world, it was all falling apart. Women poised to flip their lives, marching into a world of miniskirts, riots, shame, pillbox hats, flinging our boxy pink suit jackets and pumps into the sunset. Not even James Garner could have saved us. And this week, more unrest, more wars. I'm stuck on the headline, James Garner, dead. When I was 10, I needed a man I could count on, even a man holding aces and eights. Goodbye to James Garner, a poem by Kim Dower, from Last Train to the Missing Planet, published by Red Hen Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, now available on iOS devices, subscriptions available at poetrymagazine.org, and by Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving to calculate baseline scores. Learn more at lumosity.com. Engineered by Noah Smith, produced by Joy Boyles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
This station comes from the Augustus Brown Swimming Pool, located at 1619 Glacier Avenue in downtown Juneau, offering aqua aerobics on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 11 a.m. until 12 p.m., and stretch aquatics on Tuesdays and Thursdays from 11 a.m. until 11:45 a.m. Schedules are available online at juneau.org/parkrec/pool. More information at 586-5325.
And in the studio, joining me is Colin Wigfield Gorka. Welcome back to the studio, Colin.
Yeah, dear.
And you work at Cycle Alaska, but you're here today because you are part of this wonderful bike adventure series that Cycle Alaska hosts. And I think, is it once a month, kind of during the fall and winter season? Is that correct?
Yep, as soon as it starts getting dark and gloomy out.
Right, right. And the series is people go out and have these amazing bike adventures all over the world, and then they graciously come back and they put together a show and they present the show to the Juneau public. So that's happening tomorrow night, right? Tomorrow night at 5:15?
5:15 at the bike shop, yep.
At the bike shop. And so this time around, you happen to be the person presenting, and Brianna Swanson, I think, is also joining you perhaps in the presentation. But tell us about your adventure. I mean, you went to Vietnam, Cambodia, Thailand. Why don't you just dive into it? Tell us what you went and did, what your adventure was.
Yeah, we started in the north of Vietnam in Haiphong. It's a big port town, and all we really knew is we wanted to head south from there on bikes. And so we just kind of battled traffic and worked our way southeast through the Ho Chi Minh Highway in kind of inland area, trying to avoid the traffic and whatnot a little bit, and then ended up down in Cambodia and Thailand from there.
So when was this?
This was this last November.
So fairly recent.
Yep.
So it's a big world out there. Why in the heck did you choose hot, tropical, Southeast Asian countries? I mean, I realize there's all kinds of reasons why, perhaps, but for biking, I would think, wow, that could be a hard place to bike. So
sure, it was really hard to bike sometimes. Like in the big cities, it was terrifying. You're battling traffic. Elbow to elbow with motorcycles everywhere. But then besides that, people were so friendly, and in Vietnam especially, the traffic was moving our speed or just a little bit faster for the most part. So wasn't too bad there. But I'm not even quite sure how we decided to do Vietnam. It just sort of happened, I think.
Had you heard from others who've gone there, or was it part of it just the allure of not too many people? I guess the question is, were there other people doing kind of the bike riding that you were doing, or were you totally alien to the scene?
We were a spectacle on the roads there for sure. We ran into a few people in southern Vietnam, one person going the other way, two other people on the road another time, and that was it. So there wasn't a ton of info about it. People do it every once in a while, but we knew we wanted to go to Asia, and it seemed like a good way to do it. So it was great. Met lots of people just because we were, people would see us coming a mile away and stop off, grab a coconut water or a beer or something like that. People would check out our bikes and play with everything on there and all that, and it was pretty fun.
Now, were you camping or was it so cheap there that you didn't have to worry about that and you could just show up at the end of the day in any town and find a place to stay? How did that part work out?
Yeah, we just kind of roll into town at night and find somewhere to stay. We brought hammocks thinking we might need them in an emergency or something like that if we couldn't find anywhere, but it was so easy. It was $5 a night for, a nicer hotel room than you'd stay in the U.S. sometimes. So yeah, we were living pretty plush for the most part.
And were you, for the most part, just really biking every day, or were you being a tourist? I mean, I realize you're every all day long, you're looking at things, but yeah. I mean, were you also able to go visit sites and things like that, or was that just not part of the plan? Was it really just about the bike ride?
Yeah, I mean, we had to keep on a schedule a little bit, but yeah, we were, stopping off in the big cities. The food there is incredible, so it was just eating nonstop, and that's the best thing about bike touring. This whole adventure series, everybody focuses on that, it seems like, is the food and wherever they're at, and it's because you're so hungry the whole time. You just eat and eat and eat and eat and eat, and when the food costs a dollar or less per meal, it's amazing. You can, go from one place to the next, and you're, having five meals in a day or something like that. So lots of food tourism, for sure.
Were you, typical day, length of mile? I mean, how long were your days typically riding?
Yeah, early. It was really hot, like 6 a.m. till noon.
And let me guess, there was bugs too, probably.
Oh, no, not really.
Not too bad.
Not too many bugs. Mm-hmm. No, bugs are okay. But it just gets hot. Southeast Alaskan folks, we just didn't do well with the heat, so tried to be done by the time. It was getting up to in the southern part of Vietnam. I think our highest day was 108.
Ouch.
Yeah, it was really nasty. But, we were doing like 50, 60 miles a day, something like that by noon. And then you just have the rest of the day to wander around town, grab a beer or two. Sometimes these towns are so small, you have a chance to see every little thing there, and you hang out, and people kind of come over, and the word spreads. And before you know it, you're like, kind of the center of attention in these little towns. So it's pretty interesting sometimes.
So I imagine in some countries, there are back roads. There's kind of these, you can pick a route where maybe there's not going to be a lot of traffic. Was that available in these countries, or were you pretty much always stuck with a major thoroughfare with just a whole lot of traffic?
Yeah, there wasn't really a lot of choices, but the Ho Chi Minh Highway, which is on the interior side of Vietnam, was pretty mellow. It wasn't too bad. They love their horns there, so there was a lot of big trucks blowing horns, but they saw us in the distance. It was always really easy to spot us, and the shoulders there are wider than the shoulders in Juneau sometimes. So even when there was traffic, it never felt that dangerous until Cambodia and Thailand, and then it got, really terrifying. And some of the big cities in Vietnam, too. They were, packed wall-to-wall with traffic, and people are driving up on the sidewalks to get around things. But, for the majority of our miles, I think it was mellow. It wasn't too bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So for people who, I realize some people in the listening audience have seen some of these presentations before, but for someone who's never attended one of these presentations, what are they going to see tomorrow night? I mean, it's a slideshow, right?
And then, yeah.
So why don't you give people just a feel for what they're going to see?
Sure, yeah. It'll just be, I think kind of the idea is just a basic slideshow, lots of pictures. We have lots and lots and like way too many pictures. So just go through that and then kind of talk about the bikes and what worked for us. You know, I'm a bike mechanic, so that's always a big thing for me is gear and what works and what didn't. And so I've never done a big tour before this before. It was my
really?
First long bike tour. And
wow.
So we learned a lot along the way.
Mm-hmm.
And that was pretty cool. So I definitely want to talk about that a little bit. And we'll have the bikes that we toured on there and kind of go over all that and what was important and essential and what was stuff we never took out, that kind of thing.
So were you inspired and motivated by other presentations over the course of the last couple of years to go out and take on your first adventure like this on a bike?
For sure.
Mm-hmm.
One of our part-time mechanics and spin instructors, Alice Tiernan, who is actually right now leading a big tour across the U.S., she's always talking about it. She's, her whole life is bike touring, it seems like. So she was definitely an inspiration and want to do that kind of thing.
So last thing, I think I read somewhere, is it a fundraiser tomorrow night for Juno Rides? Is that true?
I don't think so. I think
no?
they
okay.
Yeah, they got all the money they needed. So yeah.
Okay, very good.
It's free.
So last thing, just any outrageous, adventurous moment occur? I realize the whole thing was an adventure, but I mean, is there a moment where you just feel like, wow?
Yeah. I mean, there was only one really big one, I think. We did get scammed and left at the Lao border, which is a pretty interesting story. Not the most fun day, but then the day after that was actually, I think, the most fun day of riding. And then the biggest adventure, I think, hopefully we can get Brianna Swanson up on stage to talk a little bit, because she was a vegan in a country with lots of meat eaters, and that was quite the adventure for her. So that's some good stories there for sure.
Very good. So we've been listening to Colin Wickfield Gorka talking about his trip along with Brianna Swanson, bike riding adventure through Vietnam, Cambodia, and Thailand. And you can see this presentation tomorrow evening at Cycle Alaska. I think everybody knows where that is, right there by the Douglas Bridge on the corner. Slideshow starts at 5:15, is that correct?
Yep.
Colin, thank you very much, and thanks for sharing your adventure on the radio, and looking forward to the series presentation tomorrow.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
and Jeff Brown, producer, letting me know and everybody else know we're just listening to music from Cambodia. In the studio, I'd like to welcome Maria Lovischuk and Andrea Campbell. Maria, longtime executive director, I think, for the Glory Hole now.
I think 6 years.
6 years? Very good. Congratulations on that. Andrea Campbell here. Yes, you work here.
I do.
At KTO / Coast Alaska, but that's not why you're in the studio necessarily. You're the event coordinator for the Empty Bowls Banquet.
Exactly.
Up.
I'm wearing a different hat for the next couple minutes.
So real quickly, just kind of talk about the Empty Bowls Banquet, and then
Sure. Then
I want to learn a little bit more about the Empty Bowls Project and maybe a few other things related to the Glory Hole, but
okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah, this is my second year helping with the event, my third year attending, and it's a huge event, and it's a true community fundraiser in the sense that everything comes together because so many wonderful people donate soup, they donate bowls, they donate auction items, and we have it at Centennial Hall. People come in, they get a ceramic bowl, which they get to keep. Or a wooden one. And they take it up and they get soup and bread and cookies. And then we have a silent auction and a dessert auction. And it's just an awesome event.
So this is a major fundraiser for the Glory Hole, correct?
It's our one annual fundraiser.
Mm-hmm. And how many years has the banquet been here in Juneau?
You know, I think that this is year 9.
Mm-hmm. And when I first saw Empty Bowls Banquet, I thought of Empty Bowls Project. So is it related? Are they one and the same? Is Empty Bowls Project the national thing that also happens here locally, and is the banquet connected to that?
Yeah, it is a national thing. Basically, and I think the national project started probably about 15 years ago or more, and the idea was to basically raise awareness of hunger in America. And I know that in Alaska, Anchorage has a project. I think Sitka has one. I'm pretty sure the Fairbanks Soup Kitchen has one, and Van Vee have one.
And the project is so affiliated with the Glory Hole?
It's not really like a project. It's more like a loose concept, mm-hmm. or like somebody came up with the concept, and the concept was so great, but communities picked it up.
Right.
Because basically it's a fundraiser that allows everybody in the community to participate through donating something, and then that in turn feeds the people who are hungry
mm-hmm.
by contributing to the operating funds, usually of soup kitchens.
Right. So, Andrea, this is it's April 24th, right?
Right. So it's still a little early. We're kind of in the planning mm-hmm. stages right now. Right now we are really looking for sponsors, and we are looking for auction item donations or anyone interested in donating soup. And if they are interested in doing that, they can either email info@feedjuno.org or they can call 586-4159.
And when you say sponsors, what do you mean?
We have sponsors that come in and they provide a cash donation, which helps us provide this event, helps cover expenses. It also goes into the fundraising part of things.
Mm-hmm.
We have really great sponsors already.
We do. We have quite a few.
We just really want to thank our sponsors already. We have 7 or 8 sponsors right now. I don't want to forget anybody's name, but just really grateful to North Pacific Erectors and First Bank and Volley Medical for the incredibly generous donations, and Northwind Architects.
And the Yukon Railroad.
And
Skagway.
Avista.
Mm-hmm.
How many sponsors do you need? I mean, is there kind of a certain number you need to hit to make sure you can pay for the event and have it be successful? And
yes. I think we're trying to raise $21,000. Mm-hmm. And I guess actually, so I feel a little bit bad because I said that Empty Bowls is our one community annual fundraiser. Last year, the Alaska Native community actually picked up the Glory Hole due to our burst pipes and threw us an amazing, amazing fundraiser at the Elizabeth Paradovich Hall. So I just want to be accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be an annual fundraiser going forward.
Oh. Based on the burst pipes.
Well, that one was based on the burst pipes, but I think the idea is just to get operating funds to the Glory Hole because the numbers of meals that we provide are pretty much the same. They usually provide about 55,000 meals every year. They provide between 9,000 and 10,000 emergency shelter beds, and so the need is definitely always there.
I'm glad you shared a little more information about the Glory Hole. I think it's easy to just assume everybody knows what the Glory Hole is, or they may recognize what the name is, but to actually have a little better understanding of the services provided. And you touched on it a little bit, but do you want to share a little bit more about, I mean, this amazing year-round effort that is the Glory Hole?
Definitely. And so we provide essential services. Our core mission is to provide food, shelter, and compassion to those in need. And so we do breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and we do emergency shelter for everyone. We also have a garden program. We help people find permanent housing and support them in staying in permanent housing. We do laundry and shower assistance. We collaborate with other agencies that provide food boxes to people who have homes but just don't have enough money to buy food. We do outreach to the folks who are chronically homeless. And then the latest big project that we're working on is we are part of the Juno Housing First Collaborative, which will develop and then operate 32 units of permanent supportive housing for the most vulnerable folks in Juno.
And so in addition to this major fundraiser that you've got coming up in a few weeks, how is the Glory Hole funded? I realize there's an incredible volunteer component, but just in terms of dollars.
So there's definitely an incredible volunteer component. Every night meals are pretty much cooked by volunteer groups, which is really amazing. And then we also have city funding, we have some state funding, but a lot of the donations for us come from the community. Individual donations, big and small, make up almost 45% of our revenues. So it is really, I think, a privilege to work for an organization that's so well supported by the community of Juno.
So back to the big event coming
up. We also have Juno Community Foundation Fund.
So lots of community support, but probably also a struggle every year to make sure that all the pieces tie together and that you can actually operate successfully for another year.
It is a total struggle every year. This year we've been very lucky. Our board is getting, it's always been an amazing board, but they have some people on the board now who are very interested in helping us with developing our organization in such a way that we don't have to maybe worry every year as much. And so we are hoping to implement some very concrete changes that allow us to not have a crisis every year at the end of the year. But definitely having a successful Empty Bowls fundraiser is a core activity for us to make sure that we have operating funding.
Mm-hmm. So any more information, details about the event itself or the sponsorship piece here that you want to talk about, Andrea?
The event is really fun.
It is a very fun event. And like I said, we're still kind of in the early stages. We'll be back on next month as we get closer and to discuss where tickets are being sold.
Hearthside.
Hearthside Books. But we are just encouraging people, if you want to get involved, feel free to give us a call or shoot us an email. Again, our email address is info@feedjuno.org, or you can call it 586-4159, whether you want to be a sponsor. And again, we have different sponsorship levels, so big or small donations, and then auction items if you're interested in donating soup, that sort of thing.
Oh, and it's April 24th
mm-hmm.
at Centennial Hall
at 5 p.m.
And Maria, just back to you and the year-round effort that you make and that all the volunteers make. The homeless population here, I mean, for people who don't stop and think about it every day, you see it and you live it and you're in that space every day. But is there anything you'd like the general audience just to be aware of that perhaps it's easy not to think about or be aware of on a daily basis, just in terms of the homeless population here in Juno?
Definitely. I guess one thing that what I always think about is that the people who we see on the street every day when we're walking downtown, that's a small percentage of the population of people in America who are experiencing homelessness. Most homeless people in America are actually families with young children, particularly single mothers, and also the elderly. And so I think when we think about people who are homeless, we just have to keep in mind that, first of all, anybody could be homeless. A lot of folks in America are just two paychecks away, and that what we see downtown is just a little bit of a tip of an iceberg, and it's a huge problem in this country.
So for people who want to get involved, obviously people can send a donation to the Glory Hole any time of the year, and people can volunteer and help that way. But more immediately, coming up in a few weeks, we've got this major fundraiser for the Glory Hole and all the services that you provide. So that would be another great opportunity for people in the community to participate and to in some way support the services that you provide.
Absolutely.
So Empty Bowls Banquet's coming up on Sunday, April 24th, Centennial Hall. It's a big annual fundraiser for the Glory Hole, and we've been the privilege of Maria Loveschuk, Executive Director with the Glory Hole, and Andrea Campbell, the event coordinator for the Empty Bowls Banquet. Thank you very much, both of you, for coming in.
Thank you, Jamie.
Thank you very much.
Take you a little pebble, then you put it in a pot, then you add a quart of water, and you cook it till it's hot. We're making stone soup from a pebble, soup that comes when you're adding lots of drums in a pot made of metal. We're making stone soup from a stone. That's done when you've added everyone to the beat in the bone. Then you can add some root and some chicken when it's brown. Throw in some red potatoes and some pepper when it's brown. Here come the pepper, yeah. Then maybe you got some turnips and some onions, two or three. Some garlic and some spices bring some spicy harmony. We're making stone soup from a pebble. Soup that comes when you're adding lots of drums in a pot made of metal. We're making stone soup from a stone. Soup that's done when you've added everyone to the beat in the bone. They say this country is one big old mixing pot. Just see what can happen when we mix it up a lot. Imagine what can happen just by adding you to me. A lot of tasty flavors in this kettle that is free. We're making stone soup from a pebble. When you're adding lots of drums in a pot made of metal. We're making stone soup from the kitchen, with a full belly sound and some chicken that's brown and a fat that is bitchin'. Woo! Yes! Play it, baby! Come on now! Woo!
Visit a shallow wetland in summer, and you may be dive-bombed by a slender black and white shorebird with outrageous red legs. The appropriately named black-necked stilt has the longest legs, relative to its size, of any North American bird. It uses those legs for wading, as it picks tiny insects and crustaceans from the water surface with its long, slender bill. If the stilt continues to pester you, you must be near its nest. These birds signal the approach of any potential predator. They leap into the air and call with an intensity and volume all out of proportion to their delicate appearance. The persistent calling signals that the predator has been seen and often sends it on its way. Thus, the stilt's noise and activity benefit all the birds in the vicinity. Because of this, black-necked stilts are called sentinel birds. When avocets, which breed in the same habitats, add their voices to the clamor, you can understand why no sensible predator would stick around. Birds of shallow wetlands, stilts are very sensitive to drought, which has increased with global climate change. But they readily move to new breeding areas, responding quickly when new wetlands are created. to see a photograph of those outrageous red legs and learn what's being done to conserve wetlands, come to our website, birdnote.org.
What do you get when you mash together puppetry, Maurice Sendak, and Doctor Who? A time and space-bending adventure by mask imagineers, the Wonderheads. The Juno Arts and Humanities Council is delighted to present The Middle of Everywhere, performed by the Wonderheads, a physical theater company specializing in mask performance and visual storytelling. The performance will be held at JDHS on March 21st at 7 p.m. Tickets are on sale now at the Jack, Hearthside Books, and at jahc.org.
And I'd like to welcome into the studio a couple of folks with UAS alumni. We have Dave Campbell, who is the current board president. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
And Jesse Post. And Jesse, your new title at UAS is?
The Alumni Relations Manager.
Very good. And you folks are here because you've got a major fundraising event coming up, and this is for the student scholarship program, I believe.
Correct, yeah. The Alumni Association, we do a variety of events throughout the course of the year. We kind of break them into two categories. We have a fundraiser, and then we have our friendraisers. The friendraisers are the fun events where we just try to keep people engaged with the university. But then we have a one fundraising event a year, and that's our dinner and auction. And that's what we're kind of here to talk about today. The dinner and auction, it's a really neat evening. I think this time it's going to be on Saturday, the 2nd of April. It's at the Egan Library. And it's a relatively small event. We limit the number of tables just because of the venue size to about 100 people. And we sell tickets. The ticket sales kind of cover our costs as far as like the catering for the meal and things. And then throughout the day or the event, we have a couple speakers, and then we do a silent auction and a dessert auction that's a lot of fun, and a live auction. And it's just a tremendous amount of fun. It usually lasts a couple hours. Usually by the time the night's over, we kind of have to, you know, herd people out saying, yeah,
that's a good sign.
I know you had fun, but it's time to go home, you know. And people that they go there understand that it's for a really, really good cause. I don't know how far it's gone back, but for at least the last 4 or 5 years, the event has raised enough money to where we've been able to, the Alumni Association has been able to give out 10 $2,500 scholarships to students every year for like the past 4 or 5 years. Some of that comes from some annuities we have set up, but the majority of that funding comes from the money that's generated on the night of the auction.
Mm-hmm. Very good. And so we'll talk a little bit more about scholarships and what have you, but the event itself, some of the details, Jesse?
Yeah, well, like Dave said, it's coming up in a few weeks. It's on Saturday, April 2nd, and again, it's at the Egan Library on the bottom floor there. And the time is from 6 to 9 p.m., and like Dave said, we usually try to get people out the door around 9, but it's okay to hang out and linger a little bit longer. So, yeah.
And Abby's Kitchen, did I read that somewhere?
Yeah, we've got, for dinner, we've got Abby's Kitchen lined up, and then it seems like we have a dessert auction, and then a lot of times the tables will bid on that and share some of the dessert. So it's a good way to raise money, enjoy some sweets at the end of the night, and, yeah, for student scholarships.
So for now, is this open to the general public, or is this just alumni? Or?
It is open to the general public. We have two different pricing points. If you're not an alumni member, it's $50 a ticket. If you are an alumni, I believe it's at 40.
Yep, it's set at 40. And then we're also selling tables for 8 people at $350.
Right. And the event normally sells out. It normally sells out very, very quickly. People that had gone year after year typically want to come again, unless they have some sort of travel plans, you know, that have a problem. We usually only have about 80, 85 people. Last year we ended up sitting 100 because the board who sells the tickets, we were a little bit excited to sell. And when we're all done, we were like, well, I guess we're at 100 now, even though we normally try to hit it at 15, or excuse me, 85. We had about a 15% increase in the number of seats, and then we had about a 15% increase in revenue also last year for the scholarships, which was really nice. So the tickets are on sale. They're on sale through Jesse's office, through any board member. They go quickly, and the event typically sells out very quickly as well.
How big is the alumni association or group
at
UAS?
Yeah, it's actually called the UAS Alumni and Friends Association because you don't have to be just an alumni of UAS to be a part of the group. It also wants to involve community members. And so we have over 300 dues-paying members. So That helps goes for student scholarships and for us to put on events to help keep alumni engaged and also community members. UAS is a really vibrant part of our community, so we want to invite people from the community to also support UAS and the Alumni Association.
Right. So yeah, if you've taken a few classes but never graduated, or if you've had kids or grandkids that have gone to university, or if you just like to come to Evening Egan or enjoy the library for some reason, if you have some sort of connection and you feel like you want to be more of a part of things, you can be part of the association through the Friends program. We don't distinguish between whether you're an alumni or a friend, but, you know, Juneau's so small and we all tend to run the same circles that we want to basically have as many people be able to participate as they could.
And the scholarship program, so this is one funding component of the scholarship program. There are other sources of revenue.
There are a lot of sources of revenue. But for the alumni, we have a few annuities. And then after the auction is over, we end up having a board meeting where we look at how much revenue we have and we decide what can we do as far as offering scholarships. For the past several years, we've done $10, $2,500 scholarships. And then there's a scholarship process that goes through the finance department at UAS where people have to, you know, write letters and then the board members read through them and we come up with a list. And the whole thing then goes through the financial aid services at the university. Mm-hmm. It's been pretty successful. And then typically in the fall we'll have a breakfast where students who receive scholarships from all kinds of places, not just through the UAS Alumni Association, will get together. And that way the donors can meet the students that are receiving the benefits of the funding. And that's a really positive event as well.
Yeah, that really makes it a tangible thing where the donors can actually meet the students that are receiving their scholarship. So it is a nice event that we put on in the fall for that connection to be made. So
big fundraising event coming up on April 2nd. That's on a Saturday, and we'll circle back to that again in a moment. But just some other activities, some other things that the alumni group is involved with year-round. I want to talk about.
Sure. We have what we call our 101 series, and we kind of mix it up. We've had, like, Gardening 101, and we had a Chocolate 101 about a year and a half ago. We just had Wine and Art 101.
Whose idea was that?
The Chocolate one? Yeah. I think it might have been Lynn Johnson, who's the director of the Alumni Association. So big shout out to Lynn. She does a lot of good work. And then every year there's a golf tournament that goes up to either Haynes or Gustavus. Last year's has been up to Haynes. And then typically in August there's a Mariners game where the alumni buy a bunch of tickets. And so the alumni and friends, we go there. I mean, you have to buy your own ticket. It's not like we pay for it. But you're there with a bunch of other people that have a connection to the university. So it's a lot of fun. But the big way we generate revenue for the group is this night. And it's typically a lot of fun. Some people dress up for it. It's in the main floor of the Egan Library. So when you get there, there's usually a cocktail, you know, hour, and we have students there.
I like the way you say some people dress up. It's typical Juneau, Alaska, right?
Yeah,
some people are like, what do you mean? I am dressed up.
That's right. You know, to whatever. I mean, there is no. Yeah. It's not a black tie affair, but some people dress up. Some people don't, and it's just a lot of fun. We have, you know, about 12 tables, you know, with 8 people per table, and then we have a couple of events that we have a balloon auction, and then depending on what your comfort level is, we have 3 different ways that we generate money. We have the silent auction, and then we have the live auction, and I've been the auctioneer for the past couple of years, and then we also do a dessert auction, and the dessert auction is a lot of fun because they're kind of specialty desserts that alumni people make, and Abby's Kitchen normally donates one, and what we tell the tables is, you know, pull your resources together.
Yeah.
And
have some fun.
Have some fun.
It's a fundraiser, folks.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's just an incredibly good time. I'm always very, very nervous before it starts, but by the time it's over, it's turned into one of my favorite nights of the year, and people seem to have a really, really good time. And the other kind of fun thing is that we never really know what we have to auction because they come in. So we're meeting tomorrow night, the board is, and then we're going to meet the week of the auction to kind of figure out, hey, you know, what do we have? What are we going to be, you know, giving away? And some of the stuff that I've seen come through so far is pretty cool. We've got some really interesting, what would you call them, experiences?
Yeah, I know that we're trying to get some Southeast experiences. So we've got some packages from some local tour companies. We even have a package for an African safari that's been donated. We've got quite a variety, and then just a lot of the local businesses are really gracious, and anything small or large really helps raise money. And so we've got, you know, everything from gift certificates to vacation and airline tickets. So we've got some big ticket items and then just some kind of smaller nice things that would still be nice to bring home. So
yeah, it's nice to have a variety of price points for wherever people feel comfortable for you know, their level of giving.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it's really a win-win because you get something for it. I mean, if you buy a silent auction item or, you know, a live auction, you know what you're getting, but you're also winning because the students end up getting these scholarships that come out of it. So it's a way to kind of, you know, both ends of that equation win, and it's just a lot of fun.
Anything that you wanted to mention about the big fundraiser coming up that you haven't touched on yet? Before we wrap things up here,
I would say maybe Jesse, how would they contact you if someone was interested in getting a ticket?
Yeah, if you're interested in buying a ticket for the dinner and auction, you can contact me either by calling me at 796-6569, or you can email in. The email address would be alumni@uas.alaska.edu. So that would be your way to get a ticket, or if you happen to know an alumni board member, that's another easy way to reach out and try to get a ticket. So,
and information available on the website? I mean, if somebody just Googled, would they be able to find the information about the fundraiser?
Right, they would be able to find some information at our website, which is, they could just Google UAS alumni. Yeah, that would just probably be an easier, quicker way for them to find
another thing
information.
We do that once we get closer to it is once we know what the items are.
Right.
For instance, Jesse mentioned the African safari. I believe that's a photo safari. Our former president of the Alumni Association, Barbara Burnett, went on this exact same experience. So we got pictures of her on elephants and stuff and the whole itinerary. So if there's something that we think might draw a lot of attention, people can actually bid on the items and not even be present. So you can go in and say, hey, I'm interested in this item. I'll do, you know, X amount of money. And then as the auctioneer, when the room is done, I'm like, okay, the room, you know, we're at this amount of money, and well, we have this envelope where someone made an online bid, and then we open it up, and if the online bid is higher than what the room bid, well, then that's the new number.
Right.
You know, and then people can counter it that way. And it's just a lot of fun. People have a really good time. A real good cross section of the city is there. A couple of movers and shakers usually come, you know, so it's kind of neat to be in a nice, you know, safe environment that is just there for a good cause.
Sounds great. We've been talking to Dave Campbell, Alumni Board President, and Jesse Post with the UAS staff. I forget the title. What was the title again?
Alumni Relations.
Thank you, Alumni Relations. Talking about the upcoming fundraiser for the Student Scholarship Program, and the fundraiser is on April 2nd. And thank you very much. Good luck with the event, for starters. Sounds like a lot of fun.
Thanks
and,
for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having
us. Good scholarship's always a very good thing to be doing for the community, so thanks for that effort. Good to see you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Support comes from Alaska Robotics, featuring comic authors Kate Beaton, Ryan North, Kazuo Kibuishi, and Raina Telgemeier in Juneau this April for a mini-comic convention and artist camp. Registration information at minicon.alaskarobotics.com.